welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And we have Tammy Young back with us. And
hello.
Welcome back. So we've been covering the debate on the National Bank. And what we want to do is we want to kind of dive back into that. But before we do, let me take a quick pause because this is kind of the last day of content for the week. And kind of reach into where we're going to be going in the curriculum, just so you know. So once we finish this, and we might actually get close to or finish this today, in our next show, we will be picking up the Whiskey Rebellion. And then after we kind of go through that, then I think the most important thing we can get back to is what you and I already covered during your campaign, which are the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions. So we'll kind of do an overview of that, because this sets the stage for Republic Review. This sets the stage of interposition, why interposition is the only path forward. So once we get to that, and once we cover that, we should be about ready for the Constitution, because Constitution Day is the 17th. And I don't know. I mean, I'm pretty sure the rest of America has the Constitution, or the 17th being 2 weeks from Tuesday, the 3rd. So we're just less than 2 weeks away, 12 days. And so that gives us basically 3 days, and then to cover the Whiskey Rebellion and go into those resolutions, kind of wrapping that up. So we've got kind of a tall task to kind of get that done. But once we dive into the Constitution, this is going to take a little while. Going through it 3 days at a time, we're going to be using the color-coded Constitution. We kind of actually, hint, hint, we've just talked about this. Folks, you just weren't listening in the conversation. But what we're going to do is we're going to go through the Constitutional Convention, or the Constitution with the color-coded enumerations. We have two color-coded constitutions, one with the violations, but the focus is really going to be on the enumeration, so that when we read that line, we want to make sure that we identify, is this a power? Is this a role? Is this a role for the federal government or for the state? Is this a restriction for the federal government or for the state? Is this a standard? So that way, when we cover this, it'll, I think, place better context to not just the fact whether it's being violated. So what I would ask in this process, and so I just might as well put it out there, it would be good if we could have kind of both, so that when we do hit something that is being violated, we can talk about what it is and how it's being violated. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay, great. And then once we're done with that, there are a few things that I think we kind of want to go over to build up to the Organic Act of 1791. We need to dive into this so that everybody understands that what we're dealing with is not legitimate. And what we're going to do in the process of going through the Constitution, we're going to dive deeply into the exclusive legislation. See, when people read that in Article 1, Section 8, they think that that gives, and A. Ralph Epperson, because I've talked to him, I've debated him on this, and he goes on how he interprets it and how the courts and everybody's interpret it since, that they can create any kind of legislation. That is not true. The ratification debates were very clear when they clarified the this exclusive legislation in Article 1, Section 8. And the reason why this is important is because the ratification debates, we already covered this in the last session, The ratification debates are the legal binding terms and definitions. How these things were stipulated is precisely how they are to use these definitions in applying the law, so that when the courts come along and they say, oh, well, we see it this way, and it contradicts or conflicts with how it was defined in the ratification debates, the courts are directly violating the contract. To be clear, the courts do not have the ability to change because they themselves are a creature of the compact. See, this constitution being this contract between the states, making it, because it's multiple, when you have multiple parties, that means it's a compact. And so the states being the only parties to this, when the federal government comes along and they make this assumption that they can redefine, especially the federal courts, they're redefining something like a natural born citizen. They have no license in that constitution to be able to make any changes to it. This is why in Article 5, the only authority to allow a change, a redefinition based on what was initially defined like a natural born citizen, the only way that can change is if the states allow it. Here's the problem. As long as the states let the federal government continually redefine and drag us off the cliff, we're doomed. This is why it was so important getting you into that state legislative position. Because there's no doubt in my mind, the person that you were challenging does not care about compliance to the Constitution.
No, she doesn't.
Right. And so this is why, you know, you've got 2 years to basically, you know, hone and be ready so that you can actually change. Because what ends up happening in campaigns is people want to talk about issues like, you know, do we need to extend Medicare and so forth? And what you need to do is you need to basically say, you know, it's all fine and good when people want to extend, you know, benefits, when they want to extend government into things that they want. But we don't have that government. We have a limited and defined government, and my opponent doesn't understand this. This is why, you know, we're being overtaxed. This is why government is intruding itself into our lives in aspects and ways they have no authority to do. So
even though she claims to be a constitutional conservative.
Right, absolutely. But see, between now and then, you're going to watch her like a hawk.
Oh, yeah.
You're going to watch how she votes. You're going to watch the bills that she promotes. And because she promoted bills that literally attacked or supported unconstitutional government.
Mm-hmm.
So this is how you're going to basically have a PR campaign before you even file in 2 years. You'll have a PR campaign that'll make her so miserable that she may not actually run in 2 years. Do you understand my point? Because you can make her look so bad. You can, as you call her out on everything, you can make her look so bad. So I'm gonna just say it now. It is really critical that we start getting the Wyoming meetings, the Republic Review Committee meetings going, and it is really critical that we actually start engaging Bob Worf and Pendergraft, you know, Ken Pendergraft, yes, to get into a line in understanding the importance of that bill. Now, we need to talk offline, but we need to start having these meetings. And so my suggestion, because I know the current chair of the committee for Republic Review is way too busy. And so my suggestion is that you reach out to the state chair, Frank, and talk to him about saying, hey, you know, I just ran a campaign. this gal's bad news, and I'm not giving up, and we're going to, you know, hook or crook, get her replaced in 2 years, whether that's me or we find somebody that's better. Doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. We want to get somebody in there. I may take a county commissioner's position. Doesn't matter. What matters is that we have to start meeting so that we can make sure that the legislation that needs to be presented this coming year is presented again. And yeah. So that way, so because there's scuttlebutt. You know what scuttlebutt is?
No.
Rumors. There are rumors that they may want to take the teeth out of that bill. They may want to actually, you know, convert that bill to, you know, something that is nothing. In other words, there's talk about some people touching it to make it worthless. And so we need to have an honest conversation about this. And so
Is this people in our committee or people outside of the committee?
People in the legislative process. Because there was one person specifically, but they didn't get reelected. But that one person didn't like that bill. That one person didn't like, because see, that bill demanded full compliance. It gave no latitude. It gave no leeway for politicians to compromise.
Right.
And so what they want to do is they want to be able to maintain compromise, you know, and actually have, you know, this control as they started to move this down towards the party control. In other words, the Speaker of the House would be able to, you know, put a kibosh and be able to do things that he shouldn't be able to do because he should be restricted by his oath of office. Anyway, so we can talk about this into the details, but this is a path we need to go down. But let's dive into this debate over the National Bank so that we can get this covered today. Now, one of the key things that you mentioned in the previous show was this one portion that is actually on page 2. And I want to reread this because this is Madison laying out the importance of the ratification debates. And he says, the clause is, and he's talking about this clause, whatever this discretion and these types of things, unlimited powers mean. He says, the clause is, in fact, merely declaratory of what would have resulted by unavoidable implication and appropriate and, as it were, technical means of executing those powers. This specific clause is the necessary and proper clause. This is where Hamilton started saying that that clause implies implication. We can do things because it's implied. No, it was clearly shut down as it had to be a derivative, you know, like a bank. So this is all about a bank. And they said, well, we have the ability to create debt. We have the ability to tax. And so we should have the ability to create a bank because we got to handle all this money because we believe it's implied. No, that has to be specific. And Madison was being clear here. It is not derived out of those powers. You're implying it. If it's not clearly appropriate and the technical means of those powers, and then he goes on and says, in this sense, it has been explained by the Friends of the Constitution and ratified by the state conventions, how they define that. Now, this is the next time he brings up the ratification debates. And so I know you already covered this, but I'd like you to reread this as we move forward. So go ahead and start off with the explanations in the state conventions.
Okay. The explanations in the state conventions all turned on the same fundamental principle, and on the principle that the terms necessary and proper gave no additional powers to those enumerated. I'm going to read the parentheses.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Okay. Here he read sundry passages from the debates of the Pennsylvania, Virginia, and North Carolina conventions, shewing the grounds on which the Constitution had been vindicated by its principal advocates against the dangerous latitude of its powers charged on it by its opponents.
There we go. So, okay, so He's pointing out how the Constitution was justified by the proponents to basically vindicate how the opponents were actually misconstruing, and they were actually using hyperbole. They were doing everything they can to misrepresent that document so that it would not be ratified. This is why the ratification debates are the critical, integral part of understanding the Constitution, not the Federalist Papers. And I'm not going to go down that diatribe that we started on Tuesday. So anyway, keep going. He did not undertake to vouch. Keep going.
He did not undertake to vouch for the accuracy or authenticity of the publications which he quoted. He thought it probable that the sentiments delivered might in many instances have been mistaken or imperfectly noted, but the complexion of the whole, with what he himself and many others must recollect, fully justified the use he had made of them.
And so let me actually add a little bit. So in Pennsylvania, North Carolina, New York, in all of the states that ratified the Constitution, there may have been a little bit of, you know, I didn't catch that word or what have you. So the accuracy may not be spot on. Here's the question. Are there any deviance? Is there any deviance or variation of how they were defining that clause in this debate versus this debate? No. Each time, it was always strictly held to the same standards. They just used different ways of defining it. So in other words, it is almost like you have a consensus between all of the states of how each of those clauses were defined. There is no, having read the ratification debates, there is no conflict between the state's Federalists in how they were justifying each of those clauses and vindicating basically these ill assertions by the anti-federalists, those who were trying to do anything and everything they could to defeat the Constitution. Okay, so keep going. The explanatory amendments, keep going.
The explanatory amendments proposed by Congress themselves, at least, would be good authority with them. All these renunciations of power proceeded on a rule of construction, excluding the latitude now contended for. These explanations were the more to be respected, as they had not only been proposed by Congress, but ratified by nearly three-fourths of the states. He read several of the articles proposed, remarking particularly on the 11th and the 12th, the 9th and 10th Amendments.
Right. Okay, so I'm throwing this in here because he stated the 11th and 12th articles. But these, technically, we see these in the Constitution as the 9th and 10th, because there were 12 amendments in the Bill of Rights, and the last 10 were the ones ratified. The first two were not ratified. But because these 10 were ratified, he highlights and he makes point of why these why these last two were so important, because everybody knows the 10th Amendment, all things not delegated, right? All powers not delegated to the federal government or to the states is withheld. And the 9th Amendment, as we look at the 9th Amendment, it says, this is the 9th Amendment, the enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. The right of commerce, the right to be able to survive, go and make money and be able to, you know, provide for your family. That is an essential right. And so even though there's no enumeration and the federal government has assumed this ability and got the states to assume this ability to control, you know, commerce, labor, and everything else, during the COVID pandemic, when they shut down your right, that literally violated your right to survive. And then they gave you a stipend, something that they had no authority to do even. Whether they like it or not, And the 14th Amendment steps in here. It says no state shall make or enforce any law that abridges the privileges or immunities of a U.S. citizen. And your privilege and immunity to be able to survive cannot, because it says here, the enumerations in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So this is why he's really emphasizing this importance. Okay, so go ahead.
Okay, so remarking particularly on the 11th and 12th, or the 9th and 10th Amendments, the former, as guarding against a latitude of interpretation, the latter, as excluding every source of power not within the Constitution itself.
Okay, keep going, yeah.
With all this evidence of the sense in which the Constitution was understood and adopted, will it not be said, if the bill should pass, that its adoption was brought about by one set of arguments, and that it is now administered under the influence of another set, and this reproach will have the keener sting, because it is applicable to so many individuals concerned in both the adoption and administration.
Okay, so what he's basically saying is, hey, we said that there could be no implied powers, and now they want to change this, and this is where he says that this is a keener sting because it is applicable to so many individuals concerned in both the adoption and the administration, because this is going to affect everybody. So keep going.
And fine, if the power were in the Constitution, the immediate exercise of it cannot be essential, if not there. The exercise of it involves the guilt of usurpation and establishes a precedent of interpretation, leveling all the barriers which limit the powers of the general government and protect those of the state governments.
Right. Keep going.
If the point be doubtful only, respect for ourselves, who ought to shun the appearance of precipitancy and ambition, respect for our successors, who ought not lightly to be deprived of the opportunity of exercising the rights of the legislation, respect for our constituents, who have had no opportunity of making known their sentiments, and who are themselves to be bound down to the measure for so long a period, all these considerations require that the irrevocable decision should at least be suspended until another session.
Okay. So basically, his argument is that, one, this has been locked down, that we need to move forward, and the fact that you want to drift and change this actually has to go back to the states. If you want to change and create the implied powers for the federal government, this goes back to how Article 5 requires the states to concede. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right, so going on, his next comment.
It appeared on the whole, he concluded that the power exercised by the bill was condemned by the silence of the Constitution, was condemned by the rule of interpretation arising out of the Constitution, was condemned by its tendency to destroy the main characteristics of the Constitution, was condemned by the exposition of the friends of the Constitution, whilst depending before the public, was condemned by the apparent intention of the parties which ratified the Constitution, was condemned by the explanatory amendments proposed by Congress themselves to the Constitution, and he hoped it would receive its final condemnation by the votes of this House.
Okay, so here he basically says that this concept of creating a bank has now been condemned because of all of these different factors, because of the way it was defined, because of the character of the bill, on and on and on. And so he basically says that he expects Congress to vote against this. The father of the Constitution says, and he hoped it would receive a final condemnation by the vote of this House. And so now we're going into break. And so with that, what we're going to do is we're going to have a quick pause. When we come back, we're going to pick up Fisher Ames and his comments regarding the ratification debate, not regarding the ratification debate, regarding the bank bill. And then we'll get into Jefferson, and then we'll get into Hamilton. And so stay tuned. We're halfway through. We should get this through today. We'll be right back after this. if you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so moving on, we're going to cover Mr. Ames, Fisher Ames of Massachusetts, speech on this. And so go ahead and pick up with Mr. Ames. Basically, this is what he said.
Okay. Mr. Ames, little doubt remains with respect to the utility of banks. This, however, is not a question of expediency, but of duty. We are not at liberty to examine which of several modes of acting is entitled to the preference. But we are solemnly warned against acting at all. We are told that the Constitution will not authorize Congress to incorporate the subscribers to the bank. Let us examine the Constitution, and if that forbids our proceeding, we must reject the bill, though we shall do it with deep regret that such an opportunity to serve our country must be suffered to escape for the want of a constitutional power to improve it. While the exercise of even the lawful powers of government is disputed, and a jealous eye is fixed on its proceedings, not a whisper has been heard against its authority to establish a bank. Still, however, unseasonably, the old alarm of public discontent is sounded in our ears.
Okay, so let me just jump in right here, because what he says here is not a whisper has been heard against its authority to establish a bank. In other words, with the exercise of even the lawful powers of government is disputed, with a jealous eye is fixed on its proceedings. And then again, it says, not a whisper has been heard against its authority to establish a bank. Still, however, unseasonably, the old alarm of public discontent is sounded in our ears. So it's almost like Fisher Ames is leading us down, you know, in supporting this concept of the bank. Let's keep going, though. Keep going.
Okay. Two questions occur. May Congress exercise any powers which are not expressly given in the Constitution, but may be deduced by a reasonable construction of that instrument? And secondly, will such a construction warrant the establishment of the bank? The doctrine that powers may be implied, which are not expressly vested in Congress, has long been a bugbear to a great many worthy persons. They apprehend the Congress by putting constructions upon the Constitution, will govern by its own arbitrary discretion, and therefore that it ought to be bound to exercise the powers expressly given and those only.
Okay, so basically he's conceding that they apprehend the Congress, I think the constituents, the states, putting constructions upon the Constitution will govern by its arbitrary discretion, and therefore that it ought to be bound to exercise the powers expressly given and those only. In other words, not being able to create this attachment to implied powers that Hamilton was attacking the Constitution with. Keep going.
If Congress may not make laws conformably to the powers plainly implied, though not expressed in the frame of government, it is rather late in the day to adopt it as a principle of conduct. A great part of our 2 years' labor is lost, and worse than lost to the public, for we have scarcely made a law in which we have not exercised our discretion with regard to true intent of the Constitution. Any words but those used in that instrument will be liable to a different interpretation.
Okay, so I'm going to actually throw this in. As we look at the debate, this is happening on the 3rd of February? Yeah, February 3rd, 1791. This is probably the last part of the session of the first session of Congress. In other words, the election has occurred. Some people aren't returning in the next session. And so they're trying to wrap up this bill, whether they pass it or not. And so this is hinging. The sun is setting on this session. And so this is why he kind of said, hey, you know, we're either going to do this or we're not in this session. So keep going.
The date, is that where I'm at? The danger?
Yep.
That's where, okay. The danger of implied power does not arise from its assuming a new principle. We have not only practiced it often, but we can scarcely proceed without it. Nor does the danger proceed so much from the extent of the power as from its uncertainty. While the opposers of the bank exclaim against the exercise of this power by Congress, do they mark out the limits of the power which they will leave to us with more certainty than is done by the advocates of the bank? Of the bank? That's a question. Their rules of interpretation, like contemporaneous testimony, the debates of the conventions, and the doctrine of substantive and auxiliary powers will be found as obscure and, of course, as formidable as that which they condemned. They only set up one construction against another. If, therefore, some interpretation of the Constitution must be indulged, by what rules is it to be governed? The great end of every association of persons or states is to affect the end of its institution.
Okay, so what he's basically saying is it looks like, you know, we've been, because he says earlier that we've kind of proceeded in implying powers already. And now, you know, when it comes to this very specific object, we want to do the same thing. So you can kind of see how he's arguing for the implication of power. So keep going.
Congress may do what is necessary to the end for which the Constitution was adopted, provided it is not repugnant to the natural rights of man or to those which they have expressly reserved to themselves or to the powers which are assigned to the states. This rule of interpretation seems to be safe and not a very uncertain one, independently of the Constitution itself. By that instrument, certain powers are specifically delegated together with all powers necessary and proper to carry them into execution. That construction may be maintained to be a safe one which promotes the good of the society, and the ends for which the government was adopted without impairing the rights of any man or the powers of any state.
Okay, so one of the things Madison said earlier, and we covered this yesterday, is that Madison basically says, if we create this bank, if a bank is created, we will create a creature, an artificial person. Does Congress, does the federal government have the ability to create a corporation, to create an entity? No. They don't have that ability, even though they're trying to create this, because down the road, what would keep them from creating an entity like an education department, to create an entity, you know, of all sorts of things, like health care, things that were definitely never implied? Does that make sense? So, I mean,
yep.
So Ames is kind of missing this nuance altogether. Keep going. He then asked
whether it appeared on this view of the subject that the establishment of the National Bank would be a violent misinterpretation of the Constitution. He did not contend for an arbitrary, unlimited discretion in the government to do everything. He took occasion to protest against such a misconception of his argument. He had noticed the great marks by which the construction of the Constitution, he conceived, must be guided and limited, and these, if not absolutely certain, were very far from being arbitrary or unsafe. It is for the House to judge whether the construction, which denies the power of Congress, is more definite and safe.
Okay, now he's going to reach into the preamble, which Madison didn't even address, but go ahead. He adverted to the preamble.
He adverted to the preamble of the Constitution, which declares that it is established for the general welfare of the Union. This vested Congress with the authority over all objects of national concern or of a general nature. A national bank undoubtedly came under this idea. And though not specially mentioned, yet the general design and tendency of the Constitution proved more evidently the constitutionality of the system than its silence in this particular could be construed to express the contrary.
Okay, keep going, yeah.
He had no desire to extend the powers granted by the Constitution beyond the limits prescribed them, but in cases where there was doubt as to its meaning and intention, he thought it his duty to consult his conscience and judgment to solve them. And even if doubts did still remain on two different interpretations of it, he would constantly embrace that the least involved in doubt.
Okay. And opinions on, this is the last statement here, opinions on the constitutionality of the bank bill solicited by President George Washington. Okay, so now we go to about a week, almost 2 weeks later, Thomas Jefferson comes in. Thomas Jefferson being the Secretary of State. And so now he enters into this debate because it looks like, you know, after Madison had his time up, and then Ames basically says, come on, you know, let's do what we think is best, because this preamble, and to be clear, had Madison actually basically, you know, refuted on point, you know, Ames brought up this point, then he would refute. The preamble was clearly delineated as a preamble, not delegating any power whatsoever, that you would need to go to Article 1, Section 8 to see those powers delegated. This concept of general defense and welfare was never an implied power, nor was it a delegated power. And in the ratification debates, and then he could have actually provided out of the ratification debates how that was actually sold by all the Federalists throughout these debates to prove that there was no power intended or granted in the preamble, the preamble of the Constitution, or the preamble of Article 1, Section 8. So go ahead. Let's start off with Thomas Jefferson now.
Okay. I consider the foundation of the Constitution as laid on this ground, that all powers not delegated to the U.S. by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states or to the people. 12th Amendment. To take a single step beyond the boundaries thus specially drawn around the powers of Congress is to take possession of a boundless field of power no longer susceptible of any definition. The incorporation of a bank and other powers assumed by this bill have not, in my opinion, been delegated to the U.S. by the Constitution. They are not among the powers specially enumerated, nor are they within either of the general phrases, which are the two following.
Go ahead.
The second general phrase is to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution the enumerated powers, but they can all be carried into execution without a bank. A bank, therefore, is not necessary and consequently not authorized by this phrase.
Okay, so he makes it clear that when you look at the necessary and proper clause and you look at those delegated powers to tax the states, to coin money, those things can be done without a bank. Therefore, a bank is not authorized nor necessary. Keep going.
It has been much urged that a bank will give great facility or convenience in the collection of taxes. Suppose this were true, yet the Constitution allows only the means which are necessary, not those which are merely convenient for effecting the enumerated powers. If such a latitude of construction be allowed to this phrase as to give any non-enumerated power, it will go to every one It will go to everyone, for there is no one which will in which in ingenuity may not torture into.
Keep going.
May not torture into a convenience in some way or other to someone of so long a list of enumerated powers. It would swallow up all the delegated powers and reduce the whole to one phrase as before observed. Therefore, it was that the Constitution restrained them to the necessary means, that is to say, to those means without which the grant of the power would be nugatory.
Okay, so this reminds me that we're actually going to dive into the cod fishery bounties next before we get into the Whiskey Rebellion. Because this is where, you know, in the next session, in the, you know, as these new bodies come into Congress, we now have new people that want to actually, you know, bolster up and empower the federal government more. And so we'll dive into the cod fishery bounties. And as a matter of fact, what I may do, because I'm looking at, let's just see how this goes. But the next and the final debate that really led this assault on the Constitution is by Hamilton. And so on February 23rd, now Hamilton gets in, and this is pretty close to the final comments, because at the very beginning of March is when they, you know, they switch over the, you know, to the new House. This is when everything kind of begins again. So go ahead.
The Secretary of the Treasury, having perused with attention the papers containing the opinions of the Secretary of State and the Attorney General concerning the constitutionality of a bill for establishing a national bank, proceeds, according to the order of the President, to submit the reasons which have induced him to entertain a different opinion.
The okay, first of so, these arguments, so hold on here.
Okay.
He's basically throwing out that what we all perceived as the greatest man in America is pursuing this desire. In other words, George Washington, America's beloved father, has basically said, we want to do this. To be clear, the creature, Hamilton, put this in his ear and said, we need to do these things. There's no doubt in my mind Washington did not understand, nor did he want to defend this. And so now the creature is basically using the punk card. Hey, Washington's asking for us to do this. Let's not let him down. Kind of excuse. Okay, keep going.
All right. The first of these arguments is that the foundation of the Constitution is laid on this ground, that all powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited to it by the states are reserved to the states or to the people. Whence it is meant to be inferred that Congress can in no case exercise any power not included in those enumerated in the Constitution. And it is affirmed that the power of erecting a corporation is not included in any of the enumerated powers. To this mode of reasoning, respecting the right of employing all the means requisite to the execution of the specified powers of the government, it is objected that none but necessary and proper means are to be employed. And the Secretary of State maintains that no means are to be considered as necessary, but those without which the grant of power of the power would be nugatory. Nay, so far does he go in this restrictive interpretation of the word as even to make the case of necessity, which shall warrant the constitutional exercise of a power, to depend on casual and temporary circumstances, an idea which alone refutes the construction. The expediency of exercising a particular power at a particular time must indeed depend on circumstances, but the constitutional right of exercising it must be uniform and invariable, the same today as tomorrow.
Okay, so he's really trying to basically use interpretation. He's trying to throw into this latitude of compromise. Now, one of the things that they didn't have, they did not have this thing called mature contract law. I mean, it was pretty much, you know, done by the handshake and how it was understood. But they didn't look at contract law, you know, because we had, from this point moving forward, we had delved into so many different forms of contracts to where, you know, corporations were creating contracts with people, generic contracts, licensing agreements, all these types of things that today, when you look at contract law, you know, you're living, when you got a dispute in contract law, you're living in the letter of the document itself. And had Madison basically said, hold on here, he's trying to take this latitude of, you know, going into interpretation and implication, we need to dive into the letter. Was this at all implied, or was this actually justified that the federal government would be able to do these things? And here's the question. If the federal government would be able to take these latitudes that Hamilton is asserting right here, then the states would have rejected the Constitution. There's no doubt in my mind. Okay,
yeah,
so
absolutely.
Okay, so go ahead and hit this next one.
It is essential to the being of the national government that's so erroneous a conception. Hold on, let me get that. So erroneous a conception of the meaning of the word necessary should be exploded. It is certain that neither the grammatical nor popular sense of the term requires that construction. According to both, necessary often means no more than needful, requisite, or incidental. Useful or conducive to, it is a common mode of expression to say that it is necessary for a government or a person to do this or that thing when nothing more is intended or understood than that the interests of the government or person require or will be promoted by the doing of this or that thing. The imagination can be at no loss for exemplifications of the use of the word in this sense.
Okay,
and it is true,
and
it is the true one in which it is to be understood as used in the Constitution. Oh, there we go, okay. The whole turn of the clause containing it indicates that it was the intent of the Federal Convention by that clause to give a liberal latitude to the exercise of the specified powers. The expressions have peculiar comprehensiveness. They are to make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by the Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. To understand the word as the Secretary of State does would be to depart from its obvious and popular sense and to give it a restrictive operation, an idea never before entertained. It would be to give it the same force as if the word absolutely or indispensably had been prefixed to it.
So to be clear, Madison is literally making, I mean, it's almost like he's hinging his life and the importance of Washington's desire that they must have this implied power. So go ahead and read the last one here.
Such a construction would beget endless uncertainty and embarrassment. The cases must be palpable and extreme in which it could be pronounced with certainty that a measure was absolutely necessary or one without which the exercise of a given power would be nugatory. There are few measures of any government which would stand to sever a test. To insist upon it would be to make the criterion of the exercise of any implied power a case of extreme necessity, which is rather a rule to justify the overleaping of the bounds of constitutional authority than to govern the ordinary exercise of it.
Okay, so again, implied. We can interpret all that we want, because if we need to do it, we should be able to.
Mm-hmm.
And so, go ahead, the final paragraph.
The degree in which a measure is necessary can never be a test of the legal right to adopt it. That must ever be matter of opinion and can only be a test of expediency. the relation between the measure and the end, between the nature of the mean employed towards the execution of a power and the object of that power, must be the criterion of constitutionality, nor the more or less of necessity or utility.
Okay, so what ends up happening is they finally vote and they pass this bill, and the and Congress moves forward in the creation of this bank. Now, what ends up happening between Madison and Jefferson is they're so infuriated that they really didn't know what to do, because they were caught on their heels believing that, well, this was so unconstitutional that there's just no way that they would allow this to happen. And so with this new session that just came in, I believe by this point in time, I believe at this point in time, the new session was seated for the president to be basically inaugurated in the next couple of days. So what ended up happening is Madison and Jefferson kind of took a trip, and they went up to into the northeast, into the Massachusetts area, because there was this this opportunity to kind of travel. And while they were traveling, they actually created the Republican Party, which was later spun as the Democratic Republican Party, which is a complete misnomer. That right there is the progressives basically trying to take the real sting out of the true Republican Party that these men created. Nevertheless, in 1792, we look at what we call the cod fishery bounties, and this was February 6th, just about a year later. And actually, I emailed this to you, so we can dive into this in our next session. But what we're going to do, folks, is I'm going to post all of these, but we're only going to focus on Madison's comments when Madison actually kind of takes the floor. And what we want to do is we want to focus how Madison once again shuts down, because now instead of just saying, hey, we can't take this path of implication, he now actually, for shock value, he backslaps. I mean, there's another word for it, but it's not a good word. He backhands the men in Congress trying to actually say, you know, we do have these powers of implication. Because he basically, in this, he says, if that is so, then we will eventually take over religion, education, and every matter under the sun. Because as long as we have the purse to tax, we can spend and do anything. And so everybody was aghast at, you know, how far he was going when they were just talking about giving the New Englanders an advantage bounty on the cod fishery. So with that, thank you so much. I'm sorry for not giving you a chance to say anything. I wasn't watching the time. Thank you so much, Tammy, for joining us. And folks, when we have Tammy back, we're going to dive into the cod fishery bounties so that you actually understand the limitations and how Madison basically shuts down this argument again on implication of implied powers. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.